Hi, this is Jerry from SharePoint. This episode has been recorded remotely due to the COVID-19 restrictions and therefore may contain some technical glitches. We hope you'll bear with us until it's safe to return to our regular format of recording in the breweries. Until then, thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Welcome to SharePoint, where we tap into the craft beer scene. I'm Jerry Holla, your host.
Today I'm talking with Tim Rose from Distillery Lane Ciderworks. Thanks for being on the show, Tim.
Oh, you're welcome, Jerry.
Distillery Lane Ciderworks, or DLC, sits on a farm. It's a historic site dating back to the Civil War. Share with us a little bit about that history and how that led to your name.
So the area around Burkittsville, which is the Ciderworks are right on the town line of Burkittsville. The area was the hotbed of rye whiskey distilling in the 1800s. And right across the street from the house on the property was Distillery Lane. And that led to an old sawmill converted from a grist mill, converted into a distillery run by a fellow named J.D. Aholt, a big family name in the area still today. And he made rye whiskey from grain that they grew right there, as well as grain that was imported all the way from England. But he had a big rival just up the street in the town of Burkittsville called Outerbridge Horsey III. And Horsey whiskey was renowned at the time, but he sent some of his whiskey, his rye, around Cape Horn, up the West Coast, and across the Transcontinental Railroad back to the distillery, and called it Golden Gate Rye Whiskey, and it was fabulously expensive, I'm sure. artifacts that have that name on them are very valuable. Okay. But J.D. Aholt, who was right there near the Ciderworks, he had to do something, right? Okay. And so what he did was he sent his whiskey to Rio de Janeiro and back, essentially doing the same thing. And the idea was that sloshing in the ships and going through the tropics twice somehow rapidly aged that whiskey. And so I don't know the name of what his was, but, you know, that's how he competed with the Needwood Distillery up the street. And so we've named a cider that we have now and have had for many years, Rio, in honor of J.D. Aholt sending his cider to Rio de Janeiro and back. And the reason we named that is it's aged in a rye whiskey barrel, in a used rye whiskey barrel.
Okay.
And the really fun part about this is a kind of a new, not history, but current event, mm-hmm. that we are now partnering with Sagamore Distillery in Baltimore, who are rye whiskey distillers primarily. And so now we kind of have all of this back in Maryland. So it's kind of a neat thing. So that's a little bit about the history. The farm also used to be owned by a retired general prior to the Millers purchasing the property about 25 or 30 years ago.
Uh-huh. So the Rio was actually the one of the ones that I had when I was out recently. Mm-hmm. Really good. That was a really, really nice one.
No, thanks.
Yeah, you bet. Well, you mentioned Burkittsville and that you're located just outside of that. Well, Burkittsville itself has a little bit of history that ties in nicely with this time of year. Tell our audience who's unfamiliar with the area a little bit about that.
Well, Burkittsville became famous from the Blair Witch Project, a sort of B-grade movie from quite a few years ago about a sort of haunted area that, of course, is totally fictitious. Mm-hmm. But I will tell you that nearby, and maybe this is why they chose Burkittsville, is a phenomenal hill going up a south mountain called Spook Hill that supposedly cars taken out of gear in neutral will roll uphill. And it's not true. It's a totally an optical illusion of the trees along the side of the road. But okay. If you come up to the Ciderworks, be careful if you go up the mountain, because there might be somebody sitting there
trying to move
with getting their car to roll uphill. So anyway, that's the Spook Hill. It's widely known, and it isn't true, but it's a fun thing. And every year we actually have a running club. Not this year, unfortunately. They're kind of doing a virtual version, but we have a running club that actually does the Spook Hill Run every year, and they run through the orchard.
Okay. Well, speaking of the orchard, you have a lot of space for people to spread out and remain socially distant. So tell us how that's helped your business during COVID.
We're so lucky, you know, being a farm, we have that space, like you say. And we're able to have quite a few tables spread out across the field. People can be far apart. It works really quite well. We have four spaces that can be reserved for a little bit of extra money that are undercover. And it's so far in these weeks that we've been open since Labor Day, it's actually worked out really, really very well.
Yeah, I was saying when I came up, it was a pretty busy weekend, and it was really well done as far as how spread out people were, and everyone was wearing masks, and everyone was being respectful of each other's space, and it was really good to see that happening.
That is absolutely true. We have, you know, had total cooperation as far as facial coverings go, and the social distancing. It has not been an issue at all.
Yeah, that's great. It makes people feel comfortable, and people that are itching to get out, they can get out and do it in a safe way. And so that was really great to see. So kudos to you guys for making that work, and for your customers for being considerate.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, you also have a self-guided walking tour. So share with our audience a little bit what they can expect if they come up and they take advantage of that.
It's kind of all over the place. There's a few local history signs along the 18 sign tour that they go all the way around sort of the perimeter of one of the orchards. There's not only just an informative sign, but there's the kids trivia. So it's kind of fun for families to go around. There's a geology one. I'm a geologist, so of course there's one telling about the local geology. There's quite a few about the history of apples, about the orchard itself and the horticulture practices that are used. And a couple of fun ones. There's a local place called Corkscrew that I won't tell you what it is, but Dick Cheney is involved. So there's some recent history with that one. But it's a lot of fun. You certainly will learn something, I guarantee. It's about a half a mile. And of course, I encourage people to maybe go over to the folks, pick up a bottle and a couple glasses and take a stroll.
Absolutely. And then there's some flags that I noticed, some international.
Yeah, there's a flag at each one of the signs. So it's easy to find them. Okay. There's an international flag at each one.
Okay, cool. You've been making cider for, I believe you said, 11 years. Tell us about the similarities and differences between making cider versus brewing beer.
So 20 plus years ago, I was a home brewer, and now I'm reformed. I think I told you I have made like one or two batches of beer in the last 12 or 14 years. Once I started making cider, I found out that my family really liked it. My adult children and my wife and me too. And I've really never had much hard cider, although I do know that the first alcoholic beverage I ever tasted was hard cider up in Canada in Expo 67 year. Okay. When my family went on a vacation. The big difference is cider making is like wine making. It is wine making. We're not cooking anything. Mm-hmm. Okay. We're basically just kind of controlling the fermentation and the, you know, managing the yeast properly and adjusting things depending on the temperature. We do a lot of ambient fermentation. So whatever the temperature is outside is, you know, helps me decide which yeast to use for that time. but it's actually really the most simple fermented beverage that you can make. And I tell people that all the time, and there's no really big secrets. It's good quality juice, number one, and the right kind of yeast and nutrient. And pretty much there's a lot of things you can do with it after it's fermented to make all sorts of different styles of cider. But it's a pretty easy fermented beverage to make. I have some of our tasting room staff, every year I give them a gallon of juice and some yeast and some nutrient, and they take it home and they try their hand at it. That helps them know what it's all about. And it's really not hard. And I encourage folks who have never fermented anything to maybe even think about starting with cider instead of beer. It's a lot less complicated.
Okay. That's a good advice. Well, you touched on it. So tell us a little bit about the different styles of cider. I mean, I've noticed there's traditional and graft, apple wine, ice, perry, dry, sweet, rosé, so many different styles, but tell us a little bit about some of those different styles.
So we used to say we don't do sweet, and we don't do sweet ciders. We do dry, fully dry and off dry. Mm-hmm. We do a lot of oak aging in different barrels and barrel alternatives. We make some of it carbonated, some of it is bottle conditioned, and quite a few of our ciders are still, which is a sort of something that we have to teach people about. It's one time we got flamed on Facebook by someone who said that their ciders were really good, except a couple of them were flat. And of course, they weren't flat. They were never fizzy to begin with. Mm-hmm. And that's the way cider, of course, used to all be like that. We also do quite a few cider versions with other fruit. Mm-hmm. And we make a cider, which is a combination of apple juice and honey.
Okay. So that's cider. That's okay.
Yeah.
Well, then that leads nicely into explaining to our audience, because you mentioned honey, what the difference between cider and mead would be.
Well, I don't know a lot about mead. There's so many different kinds and different fruit versions. I will tell you that I have sort of ripped off some of the things I've learned about mead fermentation, and I will often use one or two of the yeast that are commonly used by mead makers when I make that cider. It's a little bit different fermentation. It's actually one of the highest alcohol, highest ABV cider that we make. And sort of the amazing thing is we blend 10% honey in apple juice, and every time we do, it comes out at right at 11% ABV. So the bees are doing something exactly the same every single year. It's kind of a remarkable thing.
Okay, that's pretty cool. Well, your current seasonal cider is the Witch's Brew, which is appropriate with Halloween right around the corner. However, you're also doing something special with it. Share that with our audience.
Yep. So for the month of October, all the money you pay for that bottle of Witch's Brew, minus the taxes, of course, goes to the Maryland Food Bank. And we have a high expectation that we're hoping to achieve. And we're about probably getting close to halfway there. So we're a little more than halfway through, but if you come on up, you can get a glass to try, or you can buy a bottle, and that bottle will help the food bank. And I'll tell you a little bit about the Witch's Brew, which is made with really the only other fruit we grow on the in the orchard, and that is Aronia melanocarpa. It's also known as chokeberries. Okay. These are actually a native plant that grows in the Appalachians, but these are varieties that are very fruitful. And this berry has the highest antioxidant content of any fruit. And along with that comes this very incredible dark color. Mm-hmm. So we blend a little bit of aronia juice with apple juice and ferment that together. And it produces an interesting finish in the cider that comes from this very strong astringency in the aronia berries. And of course, it gives it a lovely kind of a rosé kind of color. And so it's sparkling and off dry, and it's a pretty fine thing. Actually, there was a bottle just consumed at my dinner table tonight.
What kind of flavor profile do those chokeberries add to?
We use them in such a small amount that they don't add a lot of flavor, okay, per se. It's there, and it's a distinctive flavor, but mostly it's a different finish. Most of our ciders have tannic apples in them, and those are the ones that really distinguish a craft cider from an industrial cider. Things like Dabinet and Tremlett's Bitter and Balmer's Norman. These apples have significant amounts of tannin in them, and that's what gives you a nice finish, back of the throat feel when you're drinking the cider. The interesting thing about aronia berries is the astringency in them is more forward, so it's more on the middle of the tongue. So you do get a hint of the aronia flavor, a lot of the color, and a neat little finish that our other ciders don't have.
Okay, that's great. Where can people find you online? Facebook, Instagram, Twitter?
Our website is ciderapples.com. Instagram and Twitter are DLC Ciderworks, so DL Ciderworks. Mm-hmm. And that's where you can find us.
Sounds good. Well, we'll make sure we put that on our show notes and on our website at sharepointpodcast.com. Thanks. You're welcome. Well, we learned about the cidery. Let's get to know you a little better, Tim. Tell us about your role at Distillery Lane Ciderworks.
So I got connected with them probably about 15 years ago when I was learning how to make cider in the basement and studying this wonderful British expert named Dr. Andrew Lee. And I encourage anyone who wants to make cider to go visit his website. It's called the Wittenham Hill Cider Portal. And his last name is spelled L-E-A. So if you look up Andrew Lee Apples, you'll probably go right to it.
Okay.
He is the world's really expert on cider making. He's a scientist who spent much of his career learning about the science of cider making. So I was studying and learning, and I am a scientist by training, a geologist. My real job is at the Smithsonian operating the analytical labs in the mineral sciences department.
Wow.
So science is in my blood. And of course, cider making is a lot of science, just like beer making has a lot in it too. But I was looking in the Gaithersburg Gazette, an old tabloid that used to be dropped off at your door here in Montgomery County, Maryland. And there's this article about these beer guys, and they're at this orchard, and they're picking these apples, and the names of the apples were right there in the article. And I'm going, oh my God, those are the right kind of apples. And The first thing you really need to know about making really good hard cider is, and it's kind of our motto, it's all about the apples. You have to have the right kind of apple juice to make really good hard cider. And so I saw the names of the Kingston Black and Dabinet and Tremlett's Bitter, and I had read about them, but I had no idea anybody around here was growing them. And so I called up the next day, and I was up there in a heartbeat, and I was helping Rob press apples and make juice. I think it was the day after Thanksgiving, probably about 15 years ago. And so, you know, those of us who make stuff in the basement, I always kind of think in the back of their mind, man, I think I could do this for real. And of course I had that thought. And so I would drop off a bottle or two of what I had made the previous year when I would go up in the fall and get some more juice. And so a few years after that, Rob and Patty got their winery license, and they realized they needed some help on the fermentation side of things. And they remembered me from the bottles that I had dropped off. And so, you know, I'm just telling you guys, you might not think what you wish for comes true, but once in a while it does. And it did for me. And so I started, instead of fermenting 6-gallon batches, moved up to 60 and now 500. We have currently a couple thousand gallons in fermentation already this year.
Wow.
And so that's how that happened. They contacted me and said, hey, can you come and help us? And then Rob says, as I'm leaving, and we will pay you.
Hey!
And okay. And actually, you know, I had learned so much at that point. And I said, well, that's good because, you know, I'm going to transfer a whole bunch of knowledge over to you that shouldn't be free. And so that's how that all happened. And lucky for me, my two oldest daughters had headed off to college and I had free time for about 3 months.
Okay. Fortuitous time. Yeah. well, you kind of touched on it a little bit, but because you said you started off with, you know, being a home brewer. So, you know, what was it that really got you into cider and the cider industry? How did you really make that shift and pivot?
Once I started making cider, it became, you know, really obvious. Like I was telling you earlier, it's an easier thing to do. It's fraught with a whole different set of problems that beer doesn't have. Mm. And, you know, learning how to manage some of those problems is part of the scaling up from, you know, 5 gallons to 500 gallons. And of course, you know, storage and marketing, it sounds like a lot of fun to be able to do, but you know what, there's kind of a lot of stress too. You know, suddenly when people are buying bottles of your stuff, it's great when they say, hey, this is really great. But then, you know, in the back of your mind, you know, you wonder, do they really like it? You know, and that sort of thing. And so it's a little more stressful than you would imagine.
Okay. All right. Well, leads nicely into, tell me maybe what some of your biggest challenges have been.
Biggest challenges have been bad crop years.
Okay.
And so many of these varieties naturally have a biannual crop. And that means, for example, our Kingston Black apples, which are one of our premier cider apples, produce 10 times more fruit from 1 year to the next.
Hmm.
So I might have 150 gallons of Kingston Black juice to work with 1 year and 1500 gallons the next year.
Wow.
And so, you know, if we want to keep a product the same, you know, or from those same apples from 1 year to the next, think about it. You know, we have an issue with volume. And so, you know, we've been able to overcome some of that by aging in oak for periods of time. And it sort of smooths out, you know, years where we've had a smaller crop, where we've had less juice to work with, and then an alternating year where we've had a lot. So having a bunch of oak barrels around for storing cider in has been a really great way to overcome some of this.
Gotcha. Okay. Touch on a little bit more about what's contributed to your success.
We were the first cidery to open in Maryland since Prohibition.
Wow.
The fact that these folks decided 20 years ago to plant the right kind of apples is a tremendous head start on this whole game. Like I keep saying, if you don't have those right kind of apples, you're somewhat limited in sort of the quality of craft cider that you can make. So having the foresight to plant these apples that I saw in that newspaper article and got so excited about is crucial in making good hard cider. And so, you know, people call us up and ask, they see on our website that we have these certain apples and they ask, can we get some of those from you? And the answer is, well, no, you know, those are for us. And so I think that answers your question somewhat.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you do sell apples, you know, and so, you know, I'm sure the average customer is like, well, why can't I get these apples versus those apples? But
yeah, I should tell you that, you know, amongst the cider apple varieties, they planted a lot of really neat culinary apples and eating apples, ones that you've probably never heard of. Bramley Seedling, for example, which is the most heavily grown apple in England. And it's also the most acidic apple in our orchard. It's not really good for making cider, but it works very well for cooking in many, many different ways. Another one is Calvi Blanc d'Hiver, which is a French cooking apple, which is just wonderful. And in addition to that, we have apples, old American apples like Roxbury Russet and Arkansas mm-hmm. Black. And some of those can, Roxbury Russet absolutely can be used in cider. It's wonderful. It produces fabulous aroma. But other things like Arkansas Black and wine sap and things like that, we typically sell for people to eat. And there's many, many others like I could name that every week in the fall, you know, something different will be ripe and for sale.
Wow, that's pretty
there's
cool.
a lot to choose from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, you know, you talked about, obviously, with everything that's going on with COVID, that's caused a lot of people to kind of pivot and all. So maybe it's COVID related. Maybe it's just things that help you stay committed during difficult times.
It has been really hard, especially since a lot of the business, Rob will tell you, is prior to COVID was retail. And losing the restaurants downtown in Baltimore and D.C. for the most part mm-hmm. has really hurt. But I have to tell you, that we're so encouraged by the number of people who have come out since we reopened on Labor Day. And, you know, we've had some really wonderful days, a lot of great folks come out, and you talk about encouragement, that's, you know, when you see somebody go out with a six bottles in a thing to take home, it's, you know, that is really makes you feel pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the fact that, like you were saying earlier, you know, people really need to get out and want to get out. And, our place is a perfect place to do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Done well, safe. Like you said, a lot of space, and come on out to the farm.
Everyone bring your family, bring your kids, bring a picnic. We allow food. We have some food for sale. And of course, we have quite a lineup of great craft ciders. I'll tell you, Jerry, if folks come out and have a glass or two of cider, they might see a person masked that looks kind of like me carrying around a tray with little tiny tastings of something very special, which is our Pommeau, which is a dessert wine, and the one thing that we do that is sweet. And I'll be happy to see folks and talk to them about that and anything else that has to do with cider making or what we do at the farm, the apples, whatever.
Yeah, no, I noticed that you and Rob were both, you know, very available and accessible. I did get to try that one. So maybe tease that a little bit with our audience of what to expect and entice them to come out and get it while they can.
So it's made in a close to the same process that the French make it. And that is we send 1,000 gallons or more of our hard cider to a distillery, and it comes back in this little small barrel, which is always, you know, crazy because, you know, wait, we just sent out all this stuff and that's all we got. But it's wonderful. It's, you know, it's a clear kind of a white lightning made from apples. Mm-hmm. The French call it eau de vie. They will do two things with it. Either they'll age it in a barrel and it will become apple brandy, or they will blend it with apple juice. And we do something very similar to that. And we bring the alcohol content down to 19%, which is the same as port and sherry. It's a dessert wine. Mm-hmm. And then we age it in a used bourbon barrel for a year. And it comes out this crystal clear golden color. It's got apple richness because really it's still got apple juice in it and a wonderful flavor. It's tart and it's a little bit strong. So it's a really fun addition to our lineup.
Absolutely. I sampled it. And like you said, it's very complex. It's great. No, it's definitely something that people should try to get out there while they can and try it.
Happy to have them try it.
Absolutely. Well, again, where can people find you guys online?
Ciderapples.com. And DL Cider Works.
Okay, sounds good. Well, like I said, we'll put that on our website and in our show notes. Well, Tim, I want to thank you for your time. I hope you and everyone at Distillery Lane Cider Works stays healthy and busy. And then I look forward to a time in the near future when you and I can share a pint in person.
Same to you, Jerry. And I always like to say cider is meant to be drank in pints. So So I'll make sure that happens if you come back up and see us sometime.
Sounds great. Well, we'll do that. We'll see you soon then.
Alrighty.
Share a Pint is released bi-weekly on Friday mornings and can be found at sharepintpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at @share_pint. Show notes for this episode are available at sharepintpodcast.com. Music for the show, Groundwork, provided by Kevin MacLeod, and can be found online at incompetech.com. Share a Pint is made possible by help from the Community Media Center of Carroll County. Associated with the craft beer industry and have an interesting story you'd like to share on a future episode? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at sharepintpodcast.com or email us at jerry@sharepintpodcast.com. Until the next time we share a pint, I'm Jerry Hulla. Prost.